This is a members-only bonus episode of the 7th Row Podcast. It's sponsored by you, our 7th Row members, whose support makes this podcast and everything else we do at 7th Row possible. Welcome to the 7th Row Podcast, a podcast that spotlights under-the-radar female-directed and foreign films. I'm your host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of 7th Row. Our bi-weekly bonus episodes, like this one, are a bit more informal, but just as analytical as our usual episodes. Okay, so on today's episode, we'll be talking to our very own associate editor and newly minted PhD, Dr. Brett Party, about his doctoral dissertation, which... like we often feel is sort of what we're hoping the ethos of 7th Row is. But so it is called Opening Difficult Conversations, Empathy and Intercultural Film Viewing. So we have Brett with us here today. Brett, say hello.
Hello.
And then helping me to interview Brett about his work is our executive editor, Orla Smith.
Hello. Excited to have... we've had Brett on the episodes as a guest many, many times, but now... exciting to grill him.
Well, now you have Dr. Party.
Yeah, well, different person completely.
In Brett's dissertation, like, he basically, a chunk of the research is getting people to watch, you know what, why don't you say it, Brett? Tell us what the three films are, and then I'll, so we can talk about these episodes.
Right, so the title of Intercultural Film is, it's one of those things in academia where all words are problematic in some way. So it was just eventually decided that intercultural film was the least problematic way to talk about films that were largely about kind of questioning the whiteness of the viewers who are, and then by watching stories about racialized people, that it kind of helps generate empathy. Mm. And that empathy can then actually be directed in towards kind of a feeling of actual anti-racism and work towards justice. Mm. And also, it's really difficult to narrow down, like, because when you're working with volunteer participants, you only have so much time with them, reasonably. So selecting films is, like, there's probably 1,000 films I could have selected. Mm. And I wanted to focus on Canadian films, but I was also looking for a film that was explicitly about kind of how white people don't care that someone gets into white supremacy until they've reached almost the neo-Nazi stage, at which point they're like, well, no, that's too far. But prior to that, they're like, well, he's just kind of weird. So that film was a Finnish film, Stupid Young Heart, and I interviewed the director, Selma Villanen, at TIFF a couple years ago, really enjoyed the conversation with her and the film's co-writer, Chris Kasari. So that definitely... that definitely biased my choice towards that film. And then, since I was doing research in Canada, I wanted to find two Canadian films. I selected Rhymes for Young Ghouls, both because I really love that film. And also, when I was at McGill in my first semester, there was an Indigenous film series, and that was one of the first films we watched and talked about how it was kind of an unusual choice as a film that would... you know, it opened the series, and we talked about it as, well, this maybe wasn't what someone was expecting in a film series, because it is a very stylized film, borrowing from a lot of genre elements. And we talked about how that actually may be more powerful as a way to generate empathy, because it draws people in through kind of genre film techniques and then relates it back to real things. Mm. And I wanted to explore that with my group. And then I also selected Meditation Park, directed by Mina Shum, because I was looking for a film that was relatively local. I did the research in a suburb of Vancouver, so the participants knew the area of Meditation Park decently. Like, we had a discussion after watching the film trying to pinpoint the locations, and I was interested in that one by looking at if someone kind of understands an area geographically, does that kind of change their empathy for the story that they're viewing?
So I guess the way this relates to our related episodes is we've done some episodes on two of those films, or at least somewhat related. So we did episode 39. We talked about Jeff Barnaby's two features, Rhymes for Young Ghouls, and then his second feature, Blood Quantum. And then in episode 46, that's you can listen to our conversation between Mina Shum, who directed Meditation Park, and Philippe Falardeau, who's another Canadian filmmaker who we discovered throughout that conversation inspired Mina Shum and that film.
And his films would also probably be a good choice for such a study.
And then so I asked Brett, like, what would be some good episodes that relate to his thesis, and he picked two, so now he has to explain what they are.
So in episode 68, we discussed the notorious Hillbilly Elegy and compared it to Deborah Granik's film Down to the Bone, which is one of my favorite films.
The reason this happened is because Alex was off for a week and we got to, me and Brett decided to program, we ran wild.
The second worst thing we could imagine.
Yeah, I mean, we thought about Cats first.
That's the worst thing we could imagine, but
yeah,
pairing Cats with a good film is difficult, but
yeah.
Down to the Bone is basically about the same thing as Hillbilly Elegy, but 1,000 times better.
Which is?
So they're both films about women in rural, poor America dealing with drug addiction. The perspective is a bit different because Hillbilly Elegy is from her son's point of view of that, whereas Down to the Bone is from her point of view of that. The films definitely have very differing levels of empathy for the character, especially in how they approach kind of the world of the film. Hillbilly Elegy has a very kind of gawking, voyeuristic view of this, and also very kind of, well, poor people are poor because they make bad decisions, whereas Down to the Bone shows like how hard people are working, even if there's no support around them, and has a lot of empathy for why the main character has ended up with a drug addiction, but how that's not like the only thing that defines her. And also about how her life is structured, that actually getting clean is hard. It has one of my favorite scenes where she ends up getting fired after she comes back from rehab because she's now slower at the checkout because she's not working well high. Mm. It's like, well, that's great empathy for someone that's just done a tremendous effort to get off drugs, that you fire them because their performance is a bit slower.
So why did you pick this episode as being a good demonstration of your...
I think as we look at kind of the standard Hollywood feel-bad film approach with Hillbilly Elegy, and then compare it to a film that actually is demonstrating what empathetic filmmaking looks like. Mm-hmm. And the other episode was episode 86, Una and Slalom, Depictions of Childhood Sexual Assault, because towards the end of that episode, we have a discussion about what do viewers get from watching films where terrible things happen to women, and we talk about that along kind of a gender divide and why there's value from, I mean, I always feel uncomfortable talking about a pure gender binary, but why I was talking specifically in that episode, I believe you asked me for the what's a man's point of view about these films.
Represent to all men, Brett. That's your job.
Yeah, which is, you know, something I love to do. And
we ask of you many times.
Yes. And so I thought that was a good discussion around the value of watching these films.
Yeah. I liked that episode a lot too, and it's one of our longest episodes and about one of the like toughest subject matters, so I imagine that people maybe aren't as inclined to listen to it, which is why I go off my way to recommend it and say, no, actually I think this was a really valuable conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember it being a really hard conversation to have.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember feeling we ended up doing a pretty good job with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it needed to be a long episode, mm-hmm. because that conversation is like a really complex one. Yeah. And we were talking about two films that, like, I think of the films about their subject matter deal with it better than most, but still deal with it in a very flawed way. And that's really complicated to discuss. Like,
We also ended up talking about the tale in that episode as well for quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so Brett, I guess we have the question to begin with is, what is your origin story for how you got interested in empathy through film?
And I was going to say that, like, reading, or like, not, I didn't read the entire dissertation yet, but I, like, looking through at least the opening whenever people say empathy in film, I think a lot of people think of like that Roger Ebert quote about film being an empathy machine, and that's like a big reference for a lot of people.
He definitely mainstreamed it.
Yeah, yeah. And you like very towards the beginning of your dissertation reference that quote as something that also got you thinking about it.
I do actually open the dissertation with it. I'm just looking at it now that, yeah, that's the mm-hmm. first line, that film critic Roger Ebert described movies as empathy machines, which he saw as a way to get beyond being stuck in our own experiences and towards creating an opportunity to understand more about people who, in Ebert's words, are different from the viewer in gender, race, age, economic class, nationality, profession, and have different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears, which I think that's a pretty solid definition of what is interesting about films. I think the idea of the empathy machine has been taken kind of too literally by a lot of people.
Or maybe I think some people have heard that Roger Ebert quote, like the sentiment, but not thought particularly deeply about, like, I mean, obviously not all of them have written an entire PhD thesis about it. I think he thought particularly deeply about it, but I feel like people kind of just sort of, like, stop at that quote.
Yeah, or just, I mean, it's a catchy line, empathy machines, but it, I mean, I wrote a whole chapter kind of dissecting, well, what exactly is the mechanism which would make it empathetic? It's not this kind of magical thing you just put something on and people are like, oh, I've got empathy now. Ebert's kind of not mentioning that he's bringing a lot to the film too, that the film is giving him material kind of to bring and learn with, but if you're not kind of in that mindset, it's not going to happen as easily as just, hey, it's a magic machine.
It's not enough to just have a director who is empathetic towards their characters. There are mechanisms by which you convey empathy.
And there's some directors who are good at creating empathetic stories that are definitely not empathetic people. Lars von Trier comes to mind, that I think his films can generate a lot of empathy, but clearly as a person,
that's interesting. That's really interesting to think about, because one thing I find when watching his films is like I like hate enjoying them, or I hate liking them, but like I watch his films and I do feel so deeply for the characters that it kind of emotionally wrecks you sometimes, but then you're like, Why has he done this to these characters? I feel so bad for them. I feel really deeply for them. It's interesting to think of that as, like, empathetic filmmaking.
Yeah, like, Melancholia probably has one of the best depictions of depression, but at the same time, obviously, the press conference tour for that was a nightmare.
And he's horrible to his actors on set.
Yeah. Dogville's a very empathetic film, but process of making it does not sound like it. So I got interested in films because, like, I always kind of liked movies, but I have no clue why. I took a film studies class in my first semester at university.
What were you studying originally?
I was a history major.
Okay.
And there I watched two films that, I don't know, I was blown away with by just feeling how much empathy I had for the characters on screen. One was it was actually in the textbook that I was really impressed with his quote. The film Umberto D is very good too, but the quote helped me make sense of it by reading Italian neorealist screenwriter Cesare Zavattini, who was working in post-World War II Italy. And he described, I remember reading this in the textbook, the ideal film would be 90 minutes of the life of a man to whom nothing happens. And I remember reading this line and being like, why would you want that? But as I thought for this more, I was like, oh, okay, no, I'm beginning to get this, that you get empathy just by that, but nothing happens because it's on a film, that assigns it a certain importance, that you see things that are around you all the time, but you would just ignore because they're not interesting. But if they're in a movie, like, you're forced to watch them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea of, like, Jean Dielman, for example.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the importance of affording this kind of screen presence to someone just chopping up potatoes, you know, or peeling potatoes and just going about, like, her daily life? Like, it recontextualizes those actions.
Exactly. And I found that interesting once I've kind of figured that out.
When you see that your participants kind of going through the process of figuring that out, there are some great quotes in your dissertation. One of them was somebody being like, I thought this scene was really boring and I didn't see why I was watching this. And then I realized days later I was still thinking about that scene. So I guess it actually had an impact.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, it's always fascinating which scenes stick with people and which ones don't.
Mm.
And often in films, there's like the most random of scenes. I think in that case, it was a scene of just a boy standing on a balcony. They were like, whoa, okay, so the dramatic tension here, like, is he going to fall off? Is he going to jump? But nothing happens. He's just standing on a balcony. There's no real drama in it. I don't know exactly why that... Because one of the things that's hard about asking people about what scenes are important to you is it's a hard thing to explain in words why something really connects with you emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's not something that you actively think you should be doing. Like when like you're someone who tries to write about film, that's...
It's still hard. You have kind
of tactics on how to do it, but it's still very hard.
It takes loads of practice.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible. Probably my most politically radicalizing moment was watching Rainer Werner Fassbinder's Ali Fear Eats the Soul, which is a film about racism in West Germany in the 1970s, which is basically, the film's basically suggesting, oh yeah, you guys think you're over Nazism, you're not. And I remember also in the same textbook reading his quote where he talks about loving Douglas Sirk's melodrama films, which... are probably not films that if you just described someone the plot of them, you'd think, oh yeah, a lot of empathy there. Their plots are often ridiculous. But Fassbinder describes them as, Sirk has made the tenderest films I know. They're films of someone who loves people and doesn't despise them as we do. And he was, and I thought that was interesting. It's like, okay, so what does this mean that doesn't despise people? Fassbinder made a lot of films about, at the time, West Germany was going through a what they called an economic miracle, where it was one of the world's top economies, mainly because the U.S. was pumping a ton of money into it to show that West Germany would be superior to the Soviet-backed East Germany. But so it was a really, it's kind of like today, where we have a really thriving economy, but most people don't actually benefit from it. So Fassbinder asked, if such a supposedly successful society still left out so many people, was it really successful? And his answer was that, we're kind of encouraged, we being like society in generally, despise unsuccessful people as being a personal failure, rather as Fassbinder's films attempt to show as like a structural feature that some people are always going to be left out. And so I found that interesting that film could have such kind of packed ideas to think through with what they give you to watch them. And I wanted to be very conscious not to... I didn't want this project to be something about, oh yes, this is my experience with films and I hope everyone else shares it. But I was interested that, well, if I could learn this way, could other people learn this way? And the Ebert quote was enough to signify that, it seems lots of people do learn a sense of empathy through film, but how could I kind of be more specific about that?
Can I ask why you think film specifically, because obviously it's not the only art form through which you tell a story?
I'm not sure there is anything specific to film. It's just the one I got really into.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it is in some way like combining various art forms, but I don't know. I mean, I think you can probably still conjure empathy through a good book.
Totally, and there's a long history of the novel being seen as an empathy machine as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my view is what film does is it drops you into a place and a milieu, and you get to, like, see and experience it with a person. And as Celine Sciamma has said, it's the only art form where you get to share somebody else's the only art form where you get to share someone else's loneliness. And I think it's pretty powerful, too, that you're, like, sitting there for... You know, it's a limited commitment. Like, it's, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours for most films.
I think there's that, too, that a novel is a much bigger commitment.
Well, so is a TV show, too. Or it can be. And then in the pre-COVID days, there is the communal viewing aspect, too, where you're laughing and you experience other people laughing, or you're crying and everyone around you is crying. So there is some sort of communal, like emotional experience.
Yeah.
And also think that dailiness thing of like, we're just showing kind of boring everyday stuff on screen. It's a bit harder probably to do in a novel.
But I think maybe I find it's kind of harder to get to open people up to the idea of like watching films as a way to like understand the world and other people, because we have this cultural idea of film as sort of mindless entertainment, as like something you put on to just sort of not think, whereas
totally, that is such a hard thing to break through. I taught my first film class a couple years ago, and I wasn't really prepared that I would have to do so much unlearning work with the students to realize that a film is more than just, you know, kind of your typical put on one of the first five things that Netflix recommends you.
Yeah, like we are taught how to understand literature in school. So there's this inbuilt understanding that literature is an art form through which complex ideas are expressed. And we don't teach film in schools. We kind of like a lot of people just sort of maybe go to the cinema once or twice a year to see a blockbuster and like, or like put on a film when they want to relax and not think very much. And there's just a different cultural understanding of these two things when like film also involves literature, you know, like you have to write a script. A lot of people have to write a screenplay to make a film. Like the disciplines are connected, but they're seen as like having very different purposes.
And it's also kind of assumed by a lot of people that, like, reading any book is better than viewing any film, which is, I think, a rather ridiculous proposition that, or I see this a lot with students talk about, like, they don't, that films are a waste of time because they're not, you know, true.
What?
Yeah.
Does that mean they only read nonfiction books?
Oh, that probably that too. I don't know if they read books, to be honest.
Okay, fair.
But they're very into podcasts because podcasts
are true
facts.
Yeah,
yeah. I hear Joe Rogan's really got those facts.
Yes, YouTube videos. They really like YouTube videos too. Definitely, the perception people have of film is very culturally loaded. I mean, I think that's what shocked me when I took the film studies class. I really didn't know films like that existed. And then I guess I have kind of a, when I get into a personality where I get into something, I really get into something. So I was like, okay, how many films exist out there that are interesting?
Oh dear.
Came away discovering like, there's like thousands of them.
Yeah.
But there's tons of these films. And then of course the issue is, there's tons of these films, and how do I possibly see a lot of these? Because they're not anywhere easily accessible. The first thing I did was I went to the site theyshootpicturesdontthey.com, which compiles, like, kind of aggregates all the best film lists, and so they had a top 1,000 film list. So I was like, I'm going to watch all 1,000 of them. I guess I started in 2010. Lots of them were not available in any decent quality that I could find. But now, I'd say almost all of them are available.
Did you finish the 1,000?
No, I still have, I think, 60 or so left to watch.
That's still pretty good.
But so I've made decent progress.
When I graduated high school, I got an award for like running the high school newspaper. And the award was Pauline Kael's like 5,000 movies. I can't remember what it was called exactly, but it was a book of Pauline Kael's reviews, and there were 5,000 of them. And the teacher who gave that, who picked the book, was like, well, you're gonna watch all of these by the time you're done undergrad. And I tried to explain to her that there actually weren't that many hours in 4 years. Even if I don't sleep, and I definitely have not made my way through like 90% of that in the ensuing like 15 years.
Well, and I also end up on a lot of sidetracks because through that process I discovered a lot of things that I like.
Yeah.
And so there's all these films not on the list that seem interesting, and I've not been dogmatic about the list.
So that process of like, I guess I'm curious because you sort of asked people about this and now you've had some experience, like what is the unlearning process, I guess is the one question. Then how do you get people to go, like, find somewhere useful from there. Because, I mean, something like they don't shoot pictures, don't do they? The list, like, it's a great compilation of, like, canonical films. But mm-hmm. the canon is very white male patriarchy as far as, like, how it was curated. Sure. Not that there aren't, like, films in there that weren't made by white men. There are. It's definitely going to buy, like, it's sort of like a biased starting point, but the challenge,
yeah, it seems like the list, basically, if you're interested in kind of like how the history of film developed, it's good. If you're actually looking for these are the best films, it is not a good list.
Right. But I guess I'm thinking, like, to your research, like, you've talked about, well, I'm curious, like, what is the process for getting people to unlearn their expectations for films as entertainment centers? And then I guess from there, like, how do you, if you now you've opened their eyes to film's ability to, you know, open difficult conversations about intercultural issues, like going to watch Fellini's Roma is not necessarily like the next step, but that might be what happens if you just look at the list of Criterion Collection movies.
Right. There's a lot of canonical films which are so because of technical elements that are not going to intrigue people who are into intercultural things necessarily.
Right, or because they're about white men and those lists are curated by them, so that's not really going to expand your cultural viewpoints. Yeah.
We recommend listening to the Seventh Row Podcast for some film recommendations that are outside of the canon.
Yeah.
Well, pretty much, yeah. I mean, I think that's what Seventh Row does so well, is that it's like celebrating films made by people that are not part of the canon or in the style of the canon is not something many places do. I mean, I think that's how I ended up on the Seventh Row website so much in like the early days of it before I talked to you regularly.
Oh, interesting.
Because, I don't know, like, no one else talks about these films, and that site had a lot of interesting film selections from film festivals, which were never mentioned anywhere else.
I feel like it took me a while to sort of, like, fall out of, like, feeling the obligation to watch all of the canonized films and to understand that I can just follow the stories that I'm interested in, like, learning about and the kinds of films that I'm interested in watching. But it can feel like when you're sort of getting into film that, like, well, I have to watch these, like, the 1,000 most important films, and I won't be done my film education until I've done that. But it kind of ignores that, like, maybe you're just interested in different types of storytelling, and that's okay.
Totally. Like, it really interests me how kind of, like, I mean, I was a history major. It really interests me, the history of any sort of medium. So, like, it works for me, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would start now, but if I saw the list now, but it was the sort of thing that when I was 20 really appealed to me.
And if you're going to research film, it's useful to know sort of, like, the starting point that you're working against sometimes. Yeah, I think it's, for you, it's certainly a useful tool.
A lot of my inspiration for finding films lately comes from reading books mostly about kind of post-colonial film theory and the films they mention. Mm. Mm-hmm. But if the canonized top 1,000 films are difficult to find, finding films that were released like 20, 30 years ago in Latin America.
Oh, yeah, good luck.
In any sort of decent print with English subtitles is, yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I'm curious because, I mean, this whole thesis and this whole, like, I mean, I guess our ethos as well is, like, not just watching films for the sake of watching a good film, but, like, watching a film that can have some even small effect on your life outside of watching films. And I was curious, like, as you were going through the process of discovering that and discovering films, how you think it did, like, shape you as a person, your outlook, if you think that films have a big part in shaping the way people empathize?
That is a very tough question.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I think personally for me, yes. I don't know. Like, I find films are really good for raising issues that I had no, that had never really crossed my mind, mm-hmm. and bringing it to attention to me, and then kind of showing a way of like, well, what is someone in this situation going through, and what are the constraints on what they, on what choices they have to make. Mm-hmm. That kind of, I always think a bad approach to empathy is this idea of like, well, what would I do if I was this person? Because you're not that person. It's interesting to see what that person would do in that situation and try and understand why they're making that choice.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because like thinking about my own, like how my own empathy has been shaped by films, like it can be very specific in that like, oh, I'm watching a film about an experience that I'd never thought of, that I didn't know existed, and I'm learning about it, and that's interesting. Or it could be a bit more sort of vague of like, I remember watching the movie Support the Girls at the London Film Festival, mm-hmm. at a screening, and I keenly remember, because I feel like that film is a film that is very deeply sort of, I don't know, empathetic towards its characters, warm towards its characters. And I remember leaving that screening and sort of like walking along by the Thames and like looking at the people and feeling like I was looking at the people around me with like a keener eye, like, and I was just thinking about people more. I don't know, I just felt like this warmth, and I felt like,
well, I think that's a really good example of a film that shows you something that you see all the time but never think about.
Yes, exactly.
Because, yeah, we see service workers every day.
Yeah.
The pandemic briefly brought attention to how important they were.
Yeah.
And that seems to have dissipated. But, yeah, you don't see many films about people who just work terrible jobs.
Yeah. And I think there's a power to a film that can, like, remind you to think about the lives of the people that you're encountering. Because you can just, it's so easy to sort of sleepwalk through life and not think about like what's going on with the people that you talk to even briefly. And especially if it's a service worker who like their job is set up to just be like an extension of the cash register. Some people absolutely see service workers as a extension of the cash register. I mean, I have been that person as well and felt like, you know, I'm being seen that way.
Yeah, I think what's great about film and empathy is that it is kind of unpredictable about what's going to stick with someone. I remember reading one book about education and empathy where the person writing it is horrified about the idea that empathy is unpredictable, and that because it's unpredictable, it's a bad approach for education because you never know what's going to happen. But I think that's what's exciting about it, that I really like the French theorist Jacques Rancière. He talks about political change in art in his book called The Census, and his idea is that most art explicitly about politics is horrible, is basically what he's saying. That it's just like, okay, yeah, this thing's bad, and so now you know it's bad, so you should change it. But I think we have enough sample size to safely declare that doesn't do anything. And so Rancière's interested in the idea, instead of something called dissensus, like the opposite of consensus, where you see something and it kind of changes this way that you see the world, that you kind of are jolted out of that sense of like, well, this is how I'm supposed to see things, and you see things a different way. So something like Support the Girls does that, because the like consensus way of seeing service workers is just as extensions of the cash register, essentially. But by watching the film, you get kind of that you can get that dissensus moment where you're like, oh, wait, no, those are people.
Yeah.
Which sounds like, it sounds really simple when you say it that way, but it's like kind of how the entire system is designed for us to think when we engage with service workers, is you're not supposed to feel that way.
Yeah, but it's hard to just tell that to a person.
Yeah, you can't just tell. Like, it makes no difference to tell someone like who's treating a cashier badly, like, that's a person on the other side. That won't do anything.
Yeah, or they'll say, I know it's a person, but they won't internalize what that actually means.
Yeah, I had a professor in grad school who said that Karl Marx's Capital was better than Victor Hugo's Les Mis, because one tells you what it's like to feel poor and one tells you why you're poor. But I kind of feel it's backwards, that you have to feel first before you actually care about why you should change something. Like, if you don't feel anything, that being that, like, if you don't feel that it's bad someone's poor, you don't really care about how to stop that from happening.
You showed people these films who are not used to watching films that maybe make them think. So then where do you go from there as far as getting people to have conversations about them or getting them to think critically about film?
Yeah, I think the conversation part definitely helped a lot because it helped them. I mean, it both kind of indicated that they, I guess they should be thinking about something that went on with the film. And it seemed that other people's ideas did spur other people to have ideas about the film or help maybe make sense of them in a way that they could articulate. And it seemed that they really enjoyed the process. They wanted to continue the series, even though it wasn't really planned to go past free, even. But then the pandemic hit and we never ended up doing any more of them. But there was a real excitement around the idea of kind of thinking about things. I mean, I was recruiting people who mostly were either students or who worked at the university. So they're people that they like the idea of thinking about things, I guess.
Yeah, although I felt like a lot of the responses that you quote anyway in your dissertation, some of them sound like things that like people would make fun of on film Twitter, say, like, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's surprising. It was surprising that, like, even though, like, in theory, they like the idea about thinking about things, they had not really priorly been thinking about films.
Like, you have somebody who's like, I never watch films with subtitles. I figure British and American films are the best films in the world, so why watch anything else? And I don't want to read when I'm watching movies. And then I discovered that it actually wasn't a big deal to read while watching the movie.
Yes. It turns out that subtitles scare people.
Yeah.
But then they watch the film and they're forced to pay attention, I guess. But if you're actually paying attention to the film, reading the subtitles is often not, you kind of forget about it after a while. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things, I suppose, sounds scarier in theory than it does in practice. Especially as you learn that there's really not that much dialogue in films. Yeah. That it's films are way more visual, I think, than a lot of people imagine them to be.
I mean, what were some of the other barriers that you came across?
I mean, obviously with unlearning, someone has to want to unlearn in the first place, which I don't know there's any real great way to motivate someone to want to unlearn. The way I did it was linking it to part of the intercultural thing was at that university, students need to demonstrate the intercultural competency in order to graduate, which they can do through taking a course or doing, there's a couple other options. It's mostly there's a selection of courses that count towards it. Mm-hmm. It's like an elective. And so a lot of these people in the group were people who taught at the university and were interested in kind of learning more about that intercultural competency thing. Mm. So they had a bit of a incentive to want to learn more about something, and the way we were doing it was through film. So I guess that's one approach where you kind of do the unlearning part about film in the process when they're there for learning about something else or being interested in a topic or something for some other reason than it's a film, and then the film part comes in. So I guess this could work both ways. You could be interested in a film and learn about a topic through it, or vice versa.
And when you talk about unlearning, are you just talking about unlearning people's expectations about films, or also people's expectations about colonialism or racism?
Definitely both. I was mostly thinking in that answer about unlearning expectations about film, but that through film viewing, it helps to unlearn the other part.
Right.
That with issues, especially around racism and colonialism, one of the big things is that people who are white often feel they're not actually connected to that issue in any way. And that to be connected to that issue would involve a tremendous amount of effort on their part. When really, I was thinking of it as a way to show that you're already, as a white person, pretty much implicated in colonialism and racism. And so you can understand better just how you can change how you can change what you already do to just be slightly more aware and accommodating and understanding in a way, rather than having to be like, oh, I'm going to be a white savior now. It's just as simple as, like, realizing that, say at the university, there is a lot of, so there's a lot of international students and not a lot of empathy for them necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, I think in this case, it is as, it's as simple as just kind of actually imagining the amount of effort someone goes through to be an international student, to leave home, to go to school in a secondary language, and that, yeah, there's going to be some differences in how they approach school, and it doesn't really help to not think about that circumstance and just assume they're like any other student in your class, which is kind of how it often comes across and how often the faculty think about these students.
I mean, did you have conversations about that kind of thing? Because I guess the challenge, I guess, with film is that you watch, say, Stupid Young Heart and you go, yeah, white supremacy is bad and I can see how somebody could get seduced by this. But then do you then take that and think about how I am implicated in white supremacy?
Yes, I liked Stupid Young Heart because you could start off by being, well, that's Finland's problem, except Canadians have a pretty positive view of Finland, probably. Like, I think if we watched a film about white supremacy in the United States, it would have been easily written off as like, well, Canada's, you know, better than the U.S. Mm. But, which, it's not really, but that's how Canadians feel. Whereas I don't think Canada feels a real superiority to Finland. If anything, people think of, like, Finland as having such a great education system and such a great social welfare state. So it was easy to make the link between Finland and Canada. I think if I were selecting the films again, I would have tried to find films specifically about international student experience, but it was only really coming up on my radar as a problem when I actually started talking to the people working at the university. And those are hard discussions to kind of facilitate. It's not something people like talking about. And I found a good way to kind of facilitate them was to ensure that people felt comfortable. And a good way to make sure people feel comfortable was that you could always keep relating it back to the film so that the film was always kind of there as the, we could refer to experiences that were clearly in the fictionalized world of the film and not have to actually necessarily focus on things that were real, and that helped people feel comfortable by being able to put things onto the characters that they were maybe feeling.
Do you think that film is sort of a safer place to process these things?
I think so, because it becomes your reaction to the film, and also I think it's definitely a safer place for a lot of white people, like having racism and trauma explained to them. And they'll often try and get that, like, firsthand from somebody. And it's way, I think it's way better to, like, well, people have already told their stories. You can go watch them. You can go read them. You don't have to actually, you know, press people in real life about them.
Yeah.
Say you are now drinking the Kool-Aid. You want to watch film to help you think about the world. But you want your friends to talk to you about it. I mean, maybe there isn't a good answer aside from, like, join the Seventh Row community.
That's difficult. Like, I find it really difficult to get people in my life to watch challenging films.
Me too.
And I really wish they would, because I feel like those kind of films have helped me a lot. And I want to know, like, I'm sure this is something that you're still sort of, like, grasping at. What? How do you get people to care about engaging in the first place?
I was pretty stunned that, well, I guess it's not really answering your question, because even when people wanted to engage, they really didn't know where to go.
What do you mean by that?
First of all, I don't really have a great answer of how to get people to engage, other than it definitely helped when the people wanted to continue talking to each other. So the community part does matter, I think, a lot. So it is kind of building that personal relationship and then suggesting things. But in terms of where to go, that was one of my follow-up questions to everybody who participated, was I asked them if they had a increased interest in intercultural film after viewing the free films. And they all mostly did, but their answer was all, yes, I'm definitely going to go check out the foreign section on Netflix now. Like, I think 7 of the 10 people suggested that.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, you realize that there's almost nothing on Netflix. And they were stunned. It was just, like, mind-blowing to them. Because, you know, the way Netflix is set up, it's kind of deceiving about how much is on it.
Yeah.
Because if you only scroll for the bans, you kind of assume that there's a bunch you're not seeing.
Yeah.
And most of my participants, it turns out, they watched, like, they'd search through the bans, but they would generally watch something in the first 40 or so recommendations.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But there was the idea that, well, there's more recommendations below that 40, so there's probably lots of things on there. I was like, yeah, not really.
I mean, I guess that's one of the ways how people watch is things has changed in, say, the last 10 years, is 10 years ago you would have walked into a video store and then looked around. And now it's like, well, I paid for Amazon Prime, so if it's not on there, I won't watch it. Or mm-hmm. I paid for Netflix. That's now where I get all my entertainment. And those are, like, I'm not saying don't have a Netflix. I mean, like, I use my Netflix subscription. I use my Prime subscription. But if I watched movies based on what was there, my viewing would be pretty bleak.
Yeah, I mean, my parents, for example, if they're looking for something to watch, they won't rent any. They won't rent a film, even if it's a film that they are interested in, because they're already paying for Netflix and Prime, and they want to get use out of those things, and they don't want to pay extra. So your viewing is sort of, if you have that mentality, which is an understandable mentality to have, then your viewing is quite limited to what those streamers put up, which is also very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other problem is, where do you get recommendations from people around you? What do people around you have?
Netflix,
Prime. So everyone is working from the same pretty small pool of titles now.
Yeah.
Whereas at least in the past, you were working from a larger pool, not to romanticize it too much. It's not like a lot of local video stores were particularly well-stocked with obscure titles.
Yeah.
But better. And libraries better.
I think the library stock is better now. It was not great.
The library stock's amazing, but it's not on people's minds to go track it down.
With the convenience of being able to watch something on a streaming platform, like at the tip of your fingers, a lot of people will just not go to the library. And whereas if you're, you know, choosing between a video store or a library, it's the same thing where you're making a journey somewhere and you're going to look. And
Netflix went from being the best thing to the worst thing, because the original Netflix, where it was a DVD mail service in the United States, at least had 100,000 titles.
It was pretty good here. I used to use it.
Yeah, it basically had everything that was available on the region of the DVD that you were looking for, and now it has hardly anything, and it's bigger than ever, so it's not like having a really deep catalog mattered, but I think we'll look back on that maybe as the golden age of everything being available to us.
I mean, I don't want this episode to sound like it's just been like one big plug for Seventh Row, but this is a Seventh Row podcast, and I mean, it's all well and good if we'd had a streaming service with every film, but like, how would you know?
I think that's why streaming services are popular, is that when people, my participants, began to realize how much stuff's out there, it becomes overwhelming of, where do I possibly look?
Yeah.
That's what they like about Netflix. Like, okay, it's going to give me 40 things, and one of them will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, like, why we were interested in having this episode is that we're trying to do this with Seventh Row, like, find those films and talk about how they create empathy, and talk about films not just as, like, a well-made film, but, like, as... It sounds bad to, like, call them, like, utilities, but, like, if you want to see it in, like, the most basic way possible, like, films that can actually be useful, constructive in your life, and find ways to, like, encourage people to watch them and think about them.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a role for having someone or some institution which actually advocates and curates titles. That we kind of got to this idea that the personal curator is somehow inherently a bad idea because it's too, I don't know, like we talked earlier about the canon and how it's been not very representative and things like that. But the thing with curation is there is so much out there to pick from. How do you kind of narrow down things that could be interesting? And it really depends on how much you trust what the curator's mindset of what they're curating is. I mean, if people are willing to give up the power of curation to algorithms, they should be much happier to give it up to people that are actually actively thinking about what film does. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a style of film that 7thRow emphasizes. Probably, there's two styles of film that 7thRow emphasizes. Films about social issues and films with, sorry to give you a bad time, but films with a lot of British character actors in them. And often they cross over.
Yeah, sometimes. Like, you know, Peter Lewis, both.
Yeah. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with liking films that for completely asocial reasons. Like,
yeah.
We've said that, like, film shouldn't just be entertaining, but it's also important that there are films that are very, like, entertaining or, like, visually engaging, just fun, pleasant experiences to kind of go along with the films that deeply make you think.
I mean, we did, you know, try to, like, connect Paddington to some kinds of social context, but in the end, we like Paddington because Paddington is delightful.
I mean, ideally, you could have both, but that's pretty rare. That's what makes, I think, the really great films are both.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of films worth watching that are one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But Paddington is a deep film with a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's about colonialism.
It is.
And you have to listen to our Paddington episode to find out why.
Mm-hmm.
We should probably explain, just because we're talking a bit about, like, our aims to help with that kind of curation of films that make you think about the world, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
How we're doing that. I mean, I think we're doing that in general with, like, the films we choose to publish about, the films we choose to podcast about. I mean, we podcast about films only if we think we can generate some kind of, like, discussion about, like, the context in which the film exists, the way the film engages with the world. Like, those are the kinds of films we're interested in talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're just looking for, like, specifically sort of, like, list-like curation, membership is... our membership is kind of geared towards that in a way where... Well, Alex, you can just talk about the newsletter because you curate it.
I mean, I feel like what we're trying to do is we're trying to generate using film. I mean, basically, like what Brett did in his thesis is we're trying to use film as a jumping off point to help people find a language to talk about social issues. And it could be mm-hmm. things that directly affect you or that you don't realize directly affect you. It could be about understanding other people's situations, understanding systemic issues.
And like, I feel like we've been talking a lot at, like, film festivals lately about, like, the films we thought we were really good, but the ones that stuck with us are ones where we're like, oh, I've never thought about that. I've never been able to articulate that thing in that exact way. And I feel like this film articulates that for me. I've talked about how, like Oslo, August 31st, I feel like is a really important film to me because I feel like I know people like that character who are quite hard to understand the way their minds work. And I feel like that film articulates it really well. So I can tell people, oh, watch that film to sort of understand this person in your life who's really frustrating and empathize with them. And I really value films like that feel like they've given me, like you said, like the language to understand an experience I've observed or I've had or like perhaps I hadn't even thought of. And I want to share that film with people so that they can also understand that thing and have the same, share the same language to understand it.
Right. And I guess the different things we do are different approaches to thinking about these things. So as you said, our podcasts tend to, I mean, they're panel discussions where we try and talk about the films, but the films in a wider context. And we largely pick films because we're interested in, like those films we pick are more about the content, or the kinds of questions they generate than say like, oh, this film has really great sound design is not a reason to podcast on it. But it may be a reason to talk to the director or interview the sound designer. And then I think like our with membership, you get access to our premium weekly newsletter. And that's sort of like on the ground day, like curation of what's new streaming, what's at virtual film festivals, which in virtual cinemas, and these are like the best films that you can watch now.
But I think often what we call the best films are also the films that generate, like,
yeah, not yeah,
necessarily all of them, but like it's worth saying that if you're interested in our curation, our specific taste is largely those kinds of films that we feel like there's a point to them existing, I suppose, other than just being like good.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are films, they may not necessarily directly deal with some like with like, you know, late stage capitalism or something like that, but they have some kind of key important emotional engagement or deal with some kind of social issue, even if that's mental health issues or something like that. But I feel like the newsletter is our broadest curation, right? Like that's where we'll give people the largest number of recommendations, and they aren't always mm-hmm. necessarily like our favorite films. The films that we choose to podcast on are ones that we think are really worthy of in-depth conversation. So it's like if you want,
except for Hillbilly Elegy.
Yeah, well, okay. But it's like if you want all of the options on the table of the films that we think are interesting and worth engaging with, that's what the newsletter's for. If you want like I only want to watch one or two films a week and I want to know what are the best films, that's what the podcast is for. If you then yeah. want to dive deep into like, well, actually this filmmaker has made one particularly interesting film or has a history of or a career of focusing on a particularly interesting thing, then that might be what some of our books are for. Like, what do we get from Peter Liu, and what can you understand about like how hard it is to find period costumes for working class people in the 1800s, and what does that tell us about the kinds of stories we tell about the past? Or, you know, like our Kelly Reichardt book is sort of a book about capitalism and how that is really hard on the most vulnerable people in the population. And we look at that through the lens of her films and also through conversations with her and her collaborators. And, you know, we were talking earlier in this episode about like history and how do we understand history? And that's something like how to think more critically about history is something that a lot of documentaries especially are thinking about. And so that's something that we delve into in one of the sections of our ebook, Subjective Realities, where we look at films that are reclaiming history and trying to tell an untold part of history. And I guess the other thing that our books do, and I suppose that our interviews on the site do too, is like part of being able to, you know, Brett, you mentioned that one of the challenges is you watch this film, you have a lot of feelings, but you don't necessarily know how to express them. And I think part of what you get from reading our books and our interviews and our critical analysis is to try and give you a language for talking about these things. You know, the more you hear sound designers and directors talk about sound, the more sophisticated you become as far as noticing sound and having the vocabulary to talk about sound, and then having the vocabulary to talk about how sound tells you something about like how our social systems are fucked. And so part of being able to use film as a jumping off point for these conversations is becoming more sophisticated with how you engage with and understand film language and film form. And so that's one of the things that our books do.
Yeah, and to be clear, we obviously, like, this podcast every other week has free episodes, but membership basically what it gets you is access to all our podcasts. So all the ones older than 6 months are members only, and all the ones every other week are bonus episodes that are members only. But I think they still kind of do a similar thing of having in-depth discussions about films that are worth talking about. And you also get the members newsletter. You can sign up for the free version of the newsletter, but it'll just get you a few select recommendations every week rather than giving you sort of the whole roster to browse through, I suppose.
Or even early access to it, because a big part of the premium newsletter is like virtual film festivals. So how do you see this exciting title now instead of in 6 months? You won't know that.
So it's a limited time opportunity.
Yeah, and we don't put that stuff in the free newsletter.
Yeah, so I guess this is the end of like the plug portion of the podcast, but I think it is really related to the episode as a whole, is that, yeah, like we wanted to have this conversation because it's what we're trying to do. And, you know, through membership or accessing what we do for free, we're trying to offer that kind of like guided curation to people who are interested in watching films as a way to exercise empathy.
Yeah, and I mean, okay, Brett, I understand that we like British character actors and we sometimes do fun podcasts about them, but it's not really
joking.
They're like most of our like very small percentage of our content is just about like
they're almost all bonus brand. Episodes.
They're almost all bonus episodes, and even some of them it's like who is the poshest actor in Britain was like a cheeky episode. No,
that is an important episode.
But it's who's the poshest actor in Britain is a fun episode. But it's also
It also shows you who gets to be in film.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say.
It's about class as well, as is our episode ragging on Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
Yes,
I love the line, this is a filmography of a man who seems to need money way more than he needs to.
Well, exactly. It's about like how, you know, like class and money works in the film industry and status in the film industry. Like, I think even our sort of tongue-in-cheek episodes have sort of a cultural interest to them.
Yeah. It's
inevitable because that's what you and everyone that you have on as a guest finds interesting. That lens comes through no matter what we're talking about, even if it's Paddington.
The ultimate symbol of colonialism.
Is there anything about sort of the conclusions of your research that we should maybe talk about, Brett?
I think we've covered it pretty well. It's definitely the idea that film is definitely not going to be any sort of magical empathy machine, but it does help.
Right. You need someone who's willing to do the work. They're not just going to sit back and like be gifted empathy. You need to meet a film halfway, I suppose.
Yeah, and a film that maybe you weren't expecting would ask you to do that, could ask you to do that. And so maybe you only need to meet it like a third of the way. Yeah, and that idea that bad films are telling you what to think about a political issue, but good films are kind of working to change how you see world and social structures around that issue, that's what's really going to be effective and transformative, rather than just, you know, don't look up.
Do you want to, like, hit list, name some films that are good that do this, that we can direct people to more content on?
Oh, off the top of my head, films that do this well. It's much easier to slam films that are bad at it.
Come on, Brett, just list your books. Also,
name some of the bad ones, too.
Yeah, okay, please. Name some of the bad ones.
Well, the bad ones are everything up for the Oscar, pretty much, other than... I liked Power of the Dog.
What is that addressing, do you think?
I think that is, I mean, that's a kind of a classic Western approach of masculinity is not fun.
Okay. Yeah. So
like it's not
basic.
Yeah, it's not groundbreaking, but I still liked it.
Yeah.
Compared to the others.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like one of the only real movies. So why do you hate Don't Look Up?
Well, Don't Look Up is just a... It's just a film telling you a bad thing is going to happen, that nobody cares about the bad thing happening, and then the bad thing happens because nobody does anything about it. Which, yeah, I mean, that's how things go, but just pointing that out doesn't really matter to someone, because that assumes that just realizing this is what happens through the allegory is going to actually make you care about climate change. But I mean, that's a pretty big leap. One, that's a big leap to make the for people that don't believe in climate change to make the leap from there's an asteroid about to destroy the Earth to, oh yeah, it's the exact same as the more gradual climate change.
Or COVID.
And yeah, or COVID. On the other hand, simply telling people that they're dumb for ignoring crises is not really something that's going to respond well to people, because I don't know. Also, who's going to watch that film who's not doesn't already agree with the message, basically?
Well, apparently people just watch anything that's on Netflix, so.
That's true, but then maybe they don't pay attention to it. Looking back at our old podcast lists, I think a lot of Steve McQueen's Small Axe series was interesting because it was a lot of small moments for the most part. The Assistant versus Promising Young Woman is also a really good example of looking at a film that could create empathy versus one that's probably not going to. The one that's probably not going to being Promising Young Woman.
Ah, the Oscar winner.
And the films that win Oscars are films that very loudly proclaim this is wrong. And then offer very, then also simultaneously offer solutions, which we already have. Like, Promising Young Woman's solution is, hey, look, the police will deal with it. Which,
oh, sure they will.
Which we know they won't, probably. So yeah, people like films that are like, yes, this is bad. Also, oh, look, we already got the solution. Nice.
So I guess if you want to watch films that will make you think, should become a member at 7th-row.com/join. You can check out our ebooks if you want to delve deep into films that way at 7th-row.com/ebooks. And if you become a member, you also get to join our online community and chat with other people who are also engaged with all of these things. So, Brett, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at Dr. Antique iPod.
Ooh, that's an upgrade.
Did you change it?
Ooh. I changed it.
That's you deserve it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the one place in my life I really feel that I see that I've earned the title.
Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at Orlamango on Twitter, not Dr. Orlamango, unfortunately. And you can find my writing on 7th Row, and you can find me every week on this podcast.
You can find me at BWESTCineast, that's BWESTCINEASTE. You can find me on 7th Row and on this podcast every week. You can find all of us on Twitter and Instagram at 7th Row, SEVENTHROW. And we would love to hear from you if you want to write in about your own experiences with, I guess, how films can open difficult conversations.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about, like, you know, like my story about Support the Girls or whatever, just like something, a memory of like how a film has made you think about something differently. I just find that really interesting.
So that's contact at 7th-row.com, SEVENTH-ROW.com, contact at 7th-row.com. Next week on the podcast, we will be back with a discussion of a wonderful Indigenous film called Run, Woman, Run. And in 2 weeks, we will have another bonus episode, which is a continuation of our conversation from 2020? When was this? 2020, yeah.
2020, yeah.
Oof, time, it flies. On portraits of female artists, and we're going to look at the many films of this ilk that have arrived since that discussion. So, and what they tell us about how we're telling stories about women as artists.
Yeah. I mean, I should probably say, like, since we've talked a lot about how, like, the films we discuss in this podcast, we discuss for a particular reason. Like, I mean, I think Run Woman Run is a really great example of, like, I don't know, a film that is, like, both entertaining and makes you think about a perspective that perhaps isn't your own. Actually, that episode is kind of a sequel to an episode that we did, or maybe a series of episodes we did about films about, like, coming of age in your 30s, or there was one episode we did about the 40-year-old version and Spinster, which was about two films about, like, characters who are 39, about to turn 40, and going through sort of career, relationship, upheaval in various forms in their lives. And we feel like Run Woman Run is interesting in conversation with those films as well, because it's like a similar story, but also from an Indigenous perspective, which sort of adds a new lens to that familiar kind of character arc. And so that's kind of what we'll be talking about on that episode. And it's just a wonderful film.
All right, well, that's the end of this episode. So thanks for listening.